let me ask this. This could be a fun thing to show a hand on. Like, are you into watching TV, into court TV? Anybody into that? Okay, I don't see any hands. Okay, I think this. You know what I'm talking about? Judge Judy and Judge Mathis and all these. You know what I'm talking about? Anybody like that stuff? I'm not saying it's wrong or good or bad. I'm just asking, because this is what court TV has been described as: part C-SPAN, and part Monday Night Football. It was launched in 1991 by a lawyer named Stephen Brial, who told the New York Observer that the network's success was due to a very simple reason: people are always interested in true crime. He says it's why court TV worked. It's natural drama. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end, and people want to know what happened. So I read this here. It says people are always interested in true crime. People want to know what happened. I mean, do they? Is that really what it is? I would tell you, I think people want to know what's going to happen. How's this going to turn out? Is he innocent? Is he guilty? What's the verdict going to be? So people want to know what's going to happen. Do you think people are interested in what did happen? I mean, what got us here to begin with? What was the crime? Did he do it or did he not do it? How important? So the fundamental question there is, how important is truth? And this is something I hammer on all the time. As Christians, truth is so important. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. By the truth, we are set free. But I always want to remind us of these verses here. 2 Thessalonians, I don't have these up on the screen. I wish I did. 2 Thessalonians 2:10, people perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Romans 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. I mean, this is why the wrath of God is coming, because we are people who suppress the truth. We can't handle the truth, and such is the case with Paul, who was brought before the Sanhedrin. We're in Acts chapter 23 today. To get into this, let me remind you where we've been. We've been going through the book of Acts, which I have enjoyed this series. Maybe you guys are getting tired of it. I don't know. But it's changed course over the past couple of weeks. It changed course where the book of Acts is all about the new church and how the church was growing like wildfire, and the three missionary journeys where Paul went to all these different places and planted churches, and people were coming to Christ in droves. All these things were going on. And then it took a serious turn in a different direction. I think it started about Acts chapter 19, where I tried to make the case. Paul was determined to go to Jerusalem. He was determined to go to Jerusalem. And what happened to Jerusalem? And we talked about this last week. He got there and he was falsely accused of being somebody who's against Moses, against the Jewish law, against the temple. So they're accusing him, falsely accusing him. They assaulted him. They tried to kill him. There was a big riot. And the Roman commander comes down and he arrests Paul. He arrested Paul and put him in chains. And well, Paul asked the commander if he could speak to the crowd, to this mob that was rioting, these people who hated him for some reason. He wanted to speak to him, and he spoke to him in Aramaic. He gave his story. He gave his testimony of what Jesus had done in his life. And in this testimony, he uses the word Gentile about how God had sent him to the Gentiles. And another riot breaks out. So the Roman commander has to seize Paul again and takes him back into the barracks so he wouldn't get killed. And then we pick up the story, Acts 22, the last verse of Acts 22 before we get to 23. This is verse 30. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, because of the Roman commander, he's looking for the truth. What's going on here? Why does everybody hate this guy? He can't understand it. He doesn't know what's going on. So he what's it say here? Verse 30. The commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews. He released him and ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. And then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So last week we talked about a trial before this unruly mob. And now we get a little bit more organized here because the commander assembled the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the religious body of Judea, made up of 71 elders and scribes, Pharisees and Sadducees. This is the Supreme Court of Judea. So and they come together because the Roman commander commanded them to come together. He said, I want you to find out what's going on here. You need to tell me what's this all about. So we find Paul before the Sanhedrin. Acts 23, verse 1. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. So here, Paul is declaring his innocence before God. He's, I have not done anything wrong. This is what's going on here. I've not done anything wrong. He's declaring his innocence. And in verse 2, at this, the high priest, Ananias, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on his mouth. Like, what? What's that about? I mean, here, Paul's saying, I've got a clear conscience before God. I've done what God has called me to do. Bam! All right. See, that's kind of an insult to an Israelite. We Americans, we don't like it too much either, I don't think. So, but what I want you to see, Ananias has already concluded Paul's guilty. This trial's already, it's already done. And then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sat there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. See, Paul, he kind of snaps here. He's a little upset. And I don't blame the guy. I mean, he's been falsely accused, assaulted, arrested, and assaulted again. The Roman commander brought him before these men to get to the truth, but they don't care about the truth. The truth is just, that's not what this is about. And Paul can easily see that this is, it's all rigged against him. This is unfair. He hasn't broken any laws. Yet he's on trial. And he's being tried by these people who are breaking all kinds of laws. Those who were standing near Paul said, you dare to insult God's high priest? Paul replied, brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. Verse 6, then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and others were Pharisees, he called out in Sanhedrin, my brothers, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Now, if you know the story, okay, you saw that coming. But if you didn't know the story, I didn't see that. He said, I'm a Pharisee. And get this, if you were here last week, get this here. He doesn't say, I was a Pharisee. That's how I was brought up. You know, my father was a Pharisee. I was raised as a Pharisee. He doesn't say, I was. He says, I am a Pharisee. Kind of the same thing we did last week. He says, I am a Jew. He didn't say, I was a Jew. He says, I am a Jew. What's going on? He's identifying with them. At least half of them, because half of them were Pharisees. The other half were Sadducees. We'll get into that in a second here, what that is, what that's about. But he's identifying that with them. And he says, I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. I believe in the resurrection. That's what's going on here. That's what this is all about. Paul knows that his time is short. He knows that they're not in the mood to hear a 3-point sermon. You know, you go through the book of Acts, you know, Paul has a way of now and then he just goes off and preaches for 45 minutes, but this is not the time and place for that. So he gets right to the point. He says, I believe in the resurrection. Because he knows that the Pharisees believe in a resurrection. They don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead necessarily, but they believe that there is a resurrection based on Old Testament scriptures. And there's a bunch of them. I just want to show you one right now. Psalm 16, 9 through 10. Therefore, my heart is glad, my tongue rejoices, my body also will rest secure because you will not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay. So based on that verse and other verses like it, the Pharisees who knew the Old Testament knew there was such a thing as the resurrection, that would happen someday. We would be people who would raise from the dead. And Paul gets right to the heart of the gospel here. Because we need to understand how important the resurrection is. If Christ is still in the grave, then Christianity doesn't matter at all. And this trial and everything else, I mean, why are all these people upset? Who cares if Christ never rose from the grave? But if Christ did raise from the grave, then nothing else matters. And that's what this fight is about. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is a central driving force behind Christianity. Jesus rose from the dead, which means Jesus beat death, which means we can beat death, which means I owe my life to Jesus Christ. I live for Jesus Christ. And some people just don't want to live for Jesus Christ. It's just not on their agenda. That's not on their thing to-do list. So when he said this, this is verse 7. When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits. But the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Now, what you got here going on? In Judaism, you have a split in theology. Some of them believe in a resurrection. Some of them believe in angels. Some of them believe in spirits. And others of them don't. Now, you see the same thing going on in Christianity today. In the split in Christianity today, some Christians believe the Bible is the Word of God, and some don't. Nothing's changed. Nothing new here. So this is in Judaism. There's a big split right here. In verse 9, there was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, "We find nothing wrong with this man." Oh, my gosh. Right there, the Pharisees are declaring him innocent. What if a spirit or an angel had spoken to him? Remember, this is what he's being accused of, is that he heard from God. I got to go back to Acts 20 for that. That's not in my head right now. So anyway, the Pharisees declare Paul innocent. And this is incredible. This is a major concession from the Pharisees. They're not ready to say they believe in Jesus Christ, but they seem one step closer. They seem one step closer. At least they're open to Jesus rising from the dead. Now, so I'll go back to this here. Where's that? He says, I am on trial because of my hope in the resurrection. At this, he splits the jury in half. And a big thing that's on my mind from this passage, Matthew 10, verse 16, says, I'm sending you out like sheep among the wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Paul was very shrewd. I want you to look at that verse and ask yourself, where are you at in this here? Are you like a sheep or are you like a wolf? As a Christian, you're supposed to be the sheep, okay, not the wolf. But a sheep, well, it says, but you're supposed to be shrewd like a snake. You're supposed to be innocent like a dove, but you're supposed to be shrewd like a snake. I think we got the sheep part down. I think we got the innocent as dove part, not that we are, but we know that we're supposed to be that. But the shrewd as snake, is that common? When you think of Christians, do you think of Christians as being shrewd? I'm very envious of shrewd people. I don't see myself as shrewd. But man, shrewd people, they're impressive to me. Man, here, we're supposed to be shrewd. We're supposed to be wise. We're supposed to know. This is how the world, God has given us the scriptures. He's told us how the world works. And if we know the scriptures, if we know the word of God, and we see this, we see light and darkness, we see hate and love, and you see people are anti-God and people who love God, and this is how it works. Now, if we understand how it works, we should be shrewd. And Paul was shrewd. I want you to see how Paul was shrewd. He was shrewd to call out their hypocrisy because they struck him breaking the law before even finding him guilty. So he called them out on it. I think it's true to call people out when they sin against you. You can't let that stand. You can't, hey, that's wrong. You got to call it out. And he was also shrewd because he admitted that he was wrong for being disrespectful to the high priest. Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Now I don't know why he didn't know Ananias was high priest. The meeting was kind of called abruptly. Maybe he wasn't dressed in all of his wardrobe. I don't know. It could be 10,000 reasons why he didn't realize Ananias was a high priest. But Paul was quick to humble himself. He was quick to acknowledge that he was wrong. Paul quotes the Old Testament here, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. So he's being accused of disrespecting the law. And here he's the one quoting the law. He's the one obeying the law, respecting the law, as he's being accused of breaking the law. So Paul was shrewd doing that. Paul was shrewd to submit to the governing authorities. The high priest was the governing authority. The Sanhedrin was the governing authority. And Paul writes, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. Paul also writes in Titus 3, remind the people to be subject to the rulers' authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good. See, to do this, this is how to be shrewd, guys. This is what I want to point out here. We are to slander no one. We are to be peaceable. And considerate, and show true humility towards all men. And I would tell you, Ananias was a creep. He was known to be corrupt. He was known to take bribes. He was greedy. He was called a glutton. He was all these different things. He was basically, when I think of Ananias, I think of a mob boss. He's a mob boss running the highest court in Israel. This is who he is. And yet Paul understands he has to submit, not to the man, but to the office. And I need you to apply that today with governing authorities. People who are telling you what you can and what you can't do. And it's our flesh to rebel. It's our flesh to hate that. We can't stand it. But we need to submit to governing authorities, whether it be police or the president or our parents, our teachers, our elders. And Paul was shrewd enough to let God be the judge. His job is to submit. We need to learn to submit to authorities. This is shrewd. All right, the next one really got to me here. Paul was shrewd. He was shrewd enough to shift focus from himself to something of substance. I'm thinking this might be the biggest takeaway this morning. When people falsely accuse us, and we try to defend ourselves, and usually that never ends well, Paul didn't care what they thought of him. It's about Jesus. If they like him or if they hate him, who cares? That's not what this is about. It's about Jesus. So Paul shifts the focus from himself to Jesus. Let's talk about the resurrection. I'm thinking if we really want to be shrewd, that's a good takeaway point you need to learn. If people are flattering you, where's that going to get you? If people hate you, so what? Change the subject. Bring it back to Jesus. I heard a song by Casting Crown yesterday. I think it's a brand new song. It's called Only Jesus. I don't want to leave a legacy. I don't care if they remember me. Only Jesus. I've only got one life to live. I'll let every second point to him. Only Jesus. That's what it's about. And that's how Paul lived his life. So when people attack you, bring it back to Jesus. When people flatter you, bring it back to Jesus. Fifth thing here I saw, Paul was shrewd to find common ground. He focused on areas of agreement instead of areas of division. When you engage in a debate, in an argument with somebody, when you guys are going at it, are you out to win or are you out to help the person see Jesus? And if so, then look for areas where you agree instead of areas where you disagree. I think a lot of people out there, we just focus on all the areas that we disagree with somebody. And we fight and we fight and we fight. Well, he's looking for common ground. He says, hey, I believe in the resurrection. You all believe in the resurrection. Let's talk. So anyway, this is some of the things I learned about Paul being shrewd. So what's the verdict here? The Pharisees, they decide Paul did nothing wrong. That's what they say. Now, the Sadducees, they decide that the Pharisees are stupid. And the Roman commander, he decides that he's got to get Paul out of there because he's going to get torn up again. And this is what it says in Acts 23, verse 10. The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid that Paul would be torn into pieces. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. It's another mob again. He just rescued them from a mob. And now he's got to rescue them from a mob again. This is the third time the Roman commander has rescued Paul in like the past 24 hours. It puts him back in the barracks. And I'm thinking, what's going on now? What do you think Paul is thinking about when he's locked up in the barracks? Do you think he's scared or depressed or anxious or lonely? What would you be like? I mean, if you've been here the past couple weeks, you see how things are playing out. Like, this is just, you're getting nowhere. You're just spinning your wheels here. And then verse 11, that following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." Now, see, four things happened in the barracks that night. Well, first of all, the Lord stood near him. And I want to remind us, let's not forget that when we are committed to the Lord is committed to us. Psalm 23, verse 4, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me." And Paul was experiencing that right here. Matthew 28, verse 18, Jesus, he says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely I am with you always." And do we lose sight of that? That, you know, after, you know, when despair breaks in and we feel hopeless, and we start forgetting these verses. We start forgetting that God is there, that he cares. But Paul, as he's in the barracks, and he's all by himself. Well, he wasn't by himself. He knew God was there. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul. And I hope you know that the Lord is near you, especially when you're going through hard times, when you're going through bad things. The Lord is near you. He's with you. He's in you. And as a Christian, we need to understand that. We need to know that. And think about this here, that just a few years earlier, Jesus himself, in the same city, before the same council, before Sanhedrin, what happened? He was falsely accused. So Jesus, who was standing near Paul, he'd been there. He'd done that. He's like, "I know how you feel, Paul. Yeah, it happened to me too." We have a Savior who knows and understands what we are going through. When we can't stand it, that's when he's standing by us. Hebrews 13 says, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we see here in the barracks, the Lord stood near Paul. Second thing I want you to see is that the Lord spoke to Paul. "Take courage. Be of good cheer." It can be translated either way. Take courage. Or it's one word. Take courage. But some translations say, "Be of good cheer." But I'm looking at the, you know, take courage here. Adrian Rogers, he talked one time. He bragged about how he cut off the tail of a real man-eating lion. I mean, that's courage, right? Somebody said, "Well, why didn't you cut off the head?" And he said, "Well, somebody had already done that." All right, no, that's not courage. This is a very unique word in the New Testament. It's the word tharsi, and it's only used by Jesus. It's used five times in the New Testament, tharsi. And each time it was used with the bedridden paralytic, Jesus says, "Take heart, your sins are forgiven." The bleeding woman, he says, "Take heart, your faith has healed you." When Jesus was walking across the water and the disciples, they freaked out. And Jesus said to them, take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Take courage. So a common message of Jesus. A common message of Jesus to the disciples and to the people that he was ministering to. And to us, we should be a people who take courage. Take courage. And a couple things I want you to see. I want you to see that Jesus did not come there to rebuke Paul. Like, "You messed up this time, Paul. It's not how I told you to do it, you know. You were supposed to say this. You were supposed to do this." Jesus doesn't rebuke Paul. He encourages him. He's kind of saying, well done, good and faithful servant. Paul's probably beating himself up like, I didn't do anything. Nobody's listening to me. You know, no baptisms recently. Nobody's coming to the Lord here. But yet Jesus says, take courage. Take courage. Well done, good and faithful servant. Because Paul was not called to win all the Sanhedrin to Christ. He was called to testify. It's their responsibility if what they're going to do with that testimony. Paul was faithful to do what he had been called to do, to testify. Well done. Take courage. Third thing I want you to see here is that the Lord gave Paul hope. Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Anyway, what I see here, the message is God's not done with him yet. God's telling Paul, you still have purpose. I still have a plan for you. God tells Paul, God gives Paul a promise. You're going to go to Rome. You got an all expenses paid. It's going to be great. Be of good cheer. You get to go talk to Caesar now. How else would Paul get to talk to Caesar? You can't just call Caesar up and make an appointment with the secretary. Hey, can I come and talk to you about Jesus? You can't do that. So this is how it's unfolding. This is how it's going to happen. It's great. And now that we get to verse 12. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. So, okay, we've had a trial. We find Paul in the barracks. And outside the barracks, this is what's going on here. The Jews are forming a conspiracy. More than, verse 13, more than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, we have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. That's pretty serious stuff. In verse 15, now then, you, this is what these conspirators are saying, that you, high priest, in Sanhedrin, petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here. Two things I want you to see here. The Jews were dedicated. They were determined, bound with an oath not to eat until, I mean, it's one thing to want to kill somebody, but not to eat. Bound with an oath not to eat until they kill Paul. And it made me think, in our world today, I mean, we're studying history. We're studying something that happened 2,000 years ago. A fair question is, who cares? So what? How does this apply to me today? And my answer to that is, who is that determined? And don't think about you, to come against you. There might be all kinds of reasons somebody might hate you. That didn't sound good. But why do they hate Christians in general? Why do people hate Christians? Why are people so determined to stop Christians? What is it so offensive about the gospel that people go out of their way to stop Christianity? And do you see it, or is it just me? Yeah, you see it, don't you? I mean, it's in there. I'm thinking, I don't know if it's beneficial to call them out. You know, atheists today are buying billboards to promote atheism. I mean, why do they even care? If you don't believe in God, okay, you don't believe in God. But no, they don't. They're offended if you believe in God. Why does that? Yeah, okay, we're getting excited over here. Why are they so? But people are determined. You got atheists. I don't think it's safe to name some of these groups. I'm not going to name them. But I hope you see it. I hope you see that there's a determination to stop us. And the other thing I want you to see is they will use deception to do so. They went to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, you and the Sanhedrin petitioned the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information. And you see it, the chief priests and the Sanhedrin, they were in on this. They were in on it. And this is one thing. We got these groups who are determined to come against us, and they will use deception. They will falsely accuse. They will rewrite history. That's called history revisionism. It's very dangerous stuff, and it's going on all over the place. They will indoctrinate our children, if they have the opportunity to do so, fill their heads with lies. Satan is the father of lies. And this is common. This is not something that just, this is not just a story that happened 2,000 years ago. It's happening all around us today. People are coming after the church. People are coming after Christians. And it might very well be you that gets attacked. You get caught up in all this. And what are you going to do? How are you going to respond to all this? Another thing I want you to see, going back to the barracks. One more thing that happened in the barracks. The Lord protected Paul. It's very interesting here in verse 16. This is chapter 23, verse 16. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and he told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner, sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting to ambush him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." So here, God is protecting Paul by sending Paul's nephew. The only place that we find that Paul has a nephew, the only time he's ever mentioned. But Paul's nephew is in the right place at the right time to hear about this what's going on, this conspiracy. So Paul's nephew comes to the rescue here. This is what we say, you know, Paul is relatively safe here. Never mind. Okay. I thought that was going to be good. Okay, never mind. It is. Have an off day here. Okay, so Paul, the Lord protected Paul through his nephew, and get this here, verse 23, the commander, he called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." So the commander calls for a detachment of 470 Roman soldiers. And do you see here, God is not limited in the resources he has available to him. And we know, you know, reading the scriptures, that God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. But do you understand he also owns the Roman army? They act at his command. He owns it all. Whether they want to act at his command or not, they belong to him, and they will do his will. Unknowingly. So the Lord protected Paul through Paul's nephew, through a detachment of 470 Roman soldiers, and also the commander wrote a letter. He wrote a letter. This is what the letter says, verse 26. "Claudius Lysias," this is the commander's name, "to his excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him. Because I'm a great guy, and because I had learned that he is a Roman citizen, and I wanted to know why they were accusing him. So I brought him to their Sanhedrin, and I found that the accusations had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against this man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." So, I mean, it's kind of a self-serving letter. And he said, "When I discovered he's a Roman citizen," yeah, that's because you're getting ready to flog the guy. It's politics here. But the thing I notice here, the Roman commander declares Paul innocent. He says there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. That's the Roman commander's conclusion. And then one more thing I want you to see here. The Lord protected Paul by keeping him safe in Herod's palace with bodyguards. Last verse, Acts 23, verse 35. "The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Caesarea, someplace, he said, 'I will hear your case when your accusers get here.' And then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace." So he, now, because you were thinking, you know, Paul's a prisoner. Well, he's a prisoner in a palace, okay, and with bodyguards, probably eating lobster, because God is taking care of them. Paul is a faithful servant. And God's got this. Now before we close, I'm getting ready to close, I promise. But before we close, I want to call your attention to some contrasts that I see in the story. Paul has shown repeatedly in the past three chapters, past three weeks that we've been, that he honors the law. He went out of his way to show that he honors the Jewish law. And it's the very law he's being accused of breaking. And so this is Paul on this side, and then and his accusers on the other side, who are the keepers of the law, and they pretend to be so zealous for the law, and they're continuously breaking the law. They're slandering Paul and trying to kill Paul and striking him before finding him innocent or guilty. But they're striking him in court. They're lying about wanting to see him again so they can kill him. How many laws have they violated in their tizzy to kill Paul because Paul doesn't honor the law? Who here is guilty? Who's the one that really doesn't honor the law? What's this really about? What's the truth of the matter? So there's a contrast. Paul and the law and the Sanhedrin and the law. They're the lawbreakers. He's the lawkeeper. And the other thing I want you to see, Paul was so determined to go to Jerusalem. Why? Because he wants to tell them about Jesus. Why? Because he cares about their salvation. And on the other hand, you got them who want so desperately that they're taking a vow not to eat until he's dead. He wants to save them. They want to kill him. Another contrast I see here, Paul is a servant of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ came that we might have life. The Jews unknowingly are serving Satan, and Satan is the thief that comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. Jesus is the light. And Paul is walking in the light. And these Jews are walking in darkness, and they hate the light. And I want all of us to understand, there's nothing new under the sun. You see it played out today between Israel and Palestine. Israel just wants to live. Palestine wants to destroy them, wants to annihilate them. You see the same thing going on in Christianity versus Islam, Christianity versus atheism, Christianity versus humanism, Christianity versus secularism. Jesus says, no greater, there, no servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. This is not something that happened 2,000 years ago. It's happening now because people hate the light, and we are trying to walk in the light. We are trying to tell people about Jesus. They're trying to kill us. There's nothing new under the sun. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men loved darkness instead of the light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. That's what's really going on here. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. So as our nation becomes more and more and more polarized, left versus right, or liberals versus conservatives, or Christians versus non-Christians, light versus darkness, the spirit versus the flesh. It plays out in all different ways. My message is take courage and be of good cheer. When you're falsely accused, when you're arrested, when you're assaulted, when you're treated unfairly, hopefully nobody here has a band of assassins that are taking a vow to try to kill you. But if they do, take courage. Because God's got this. God, and I see through this, God can use his enemies, even his enemies, to accomplish his will. He can use his enemies to protect his people. Now, Paul was in good hands. Didn't look like it. I mean, he's probably, I can imagine if we were in his position, we'd be terrified. But he was in good hands. God used the Roman commander to take care of Paul. Remember, he used Pharaoh to take care of Moses when Moses was a child. God can use his enemies to get you to where he wants you to be, to get Paul to Caesar. In Romans 8, verse 28, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. This is how God works. So are you going to give up? You're going to quit? You're going to get scared? You're going to start doubting because Satan's putting all these lies in your head? Or do you understand God is faithful, God is good? It says in Romans 15, verse 4, everything that has been written in the past was written to teach us so that through endurance and encouragement of the scriptures, we might have hope so that we can have courage when our time comes, when it happens to us. Philippians 1, verse 6, he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. All you have to do is be faithful. All you have to do is continue to walk in the light, to do what God has called you to do, and to do it his way, be obedient, and take courage. God is with you. God's got this. Lead me to